From WHYY in Philadelphia, this is Fresh Air. I'm Artie Moscowane, sitting in for Terry Gross. Traditionally, journalism was a man's domain. That was certainly the case back in 1963 when Nan Robertson joined the New York Times as a reporter. On this edition of Fresh Air, Robertson tells us about the long struggle to get the Times and the rest of the media to treat women as equals. Also today, we take a look at modern Japanese society. Norma Field is half Japanese and half American. She grew up in post-war Japan, and she's had a foot in each culture ever since. And jazz critic Kevin Whitehead tells us about two big bands that are putting a new twist on the big band tradition. That's all coming up on today's Fresh Air. First, the news.
From National Public Radio News in Washington, I'm Corey Flintoff. President Bush attacked the Democrats' economic recovery package today, saying its tax cut offers little real benefit to the average family. NPR's Richard Gonzalez reports.
Mr. Bush made another pitch for his economic recovery plan today before an audience of state lawmakers at the White House. He criticized the Democrats for wanting to raise taxes and spending, and he ridiculed their plan for a middle-class tax cut.
If you belong to an average family of four, their scheme will give you about a quarter a day. And even the tooth fairy pays more than that in there.
The president asked his audience to pressure Congress to meet his March 20th deadline for action on his economic recovery plan, which includes incentives for investment and other tax breaks. Mr. Bush also criticized Congress for approving federal programs without providing adequate funding, thereby placing an undue burden on state governments. I'm Richard Gonzalez in Washington.
The president went on to Charleston, South Carolina today, where he and conservative columnist Patrick Buchanan are trying to marshal support in the state's March 7th primary. Mr. Bush addressed about 1,000 people at the Southern Republican Leadership Conference, saying that he was confident but needed their backing. At a hotel across the street, challenger Patrick Buchanan said he'd come to crash the party and predicted that he'd make a strong showing in the primary. A 5-year-old girl has been killed in northern Israel after a Katyusha rocket fired from southern Lebanon hit a collective farmhouse. The attack came hours after Israeli troops pulled back from their mission in southern Lebanon to find Hezbollah guerrilla rocket launching sites. Patricia Golan reports.
24 hours after Israel launched a ground operation north of Israel's self-declared security zone in southern Lebanon, troops and tanks withdrew. The action to destroy rocket-launching bases operated by the Iranian-backed Hezbollah was declared a complete success. But within hours, Hezbollah guerrillas launched fresh salvos of Katyusha rockets, one of them killing a child and wounding several others in a collective farm in the western Galilee near the Israeli-Lebanese border. This is the first time since the Katyusha rocket barrage began last weekend that a rocket fired from Lebanon has caused any real damage or casualties. Israeli government leaders and army officers warned they would move in again if Hezbollah resumed its attacks. A UN spokesman in the area has described the situation in South Lebanon as volatile. For National Public Radio, this is Patricia Golan in Jerusalem.
Secretary of State James Baker met today with Israeli Ambassador Zalman Shoval, but the two failed to agree on conditions for $10 billion in U.S. loan guarantees. Israel wants the backing so it can borrow money to help settle Soviet immigrants. The U.S. has demanded a ban on any new building of Jewish settlements in the occupied territories as a condition for guaranteeing the loans. On Wall Street today, the Dow Jones Industrial Average lost less than half a point to close at 3,280. This is NPR. The head of the European Commission said today that it's up to President Bush to make concessions to break a deadlock in the GATT talks. The general agreement on tariffs and trade is aimed at liberalizing world trading rules, but the United States and the European community have deadlocked over the issue of subsidies for farmers and farm exports. EC President Jacques Delors said that U.S. negotiators have refused to budge on the issue and that President Bush should work for a compromise. United Nations Weapons Inspector Rolf Ikeas is in Baghdad. He's warning the Iraqi government that it must comply with U.N. resolutions on Iraqi disarmament. He says there will be serious consequences if Baghdad does not comply. Gerald Butt filed this report for the BBC.
Various U.N. weapons teams have been carrying out work in Iraq for 9 months now. And in that time, a number of complaints have been made to the effect that the Iraqi authorities are failing to cooperate fully with the inspectors. The The United Nations Security Council has been deliberating on how best to deal with what's perceived as deliberate foot-dragging by the Iraqis. As a first step, they've dispatched Mr. Ekeos to Baghdad. Between now and Monday, he'll be having talks with Iraqi leaders. He's been told to pass on to the Baghdad government the determination of the Security Council to see the conditions of the Gulf War ceasefire implemented to the letter. He'll also be telling the Iraqis that they face serious consequences if they fail to heed this latest warning.
Gerald Butt reporting. American skater Christy Yamaguchi won the gold medal today in women's figure skating at the Olympic Winter Games. Yamaguchi won despite a near fall and an error in her routine after other competitors suffered falls and mistakes trying to overtake her. The 20-year-old from Fremont, California, earned 8 marks of 5.9 out of the maximum of 6 points for artistry. Japan's Midori Ito took the silver medal despite a fall, and Nancy Kerrigan of Stoneham, Massachusetts, won the bronze. I'm Corey Flintoff, NPR News.
This is Fresh Air. I'm Artie Moss-Cohen. Nan Robertson loved the newspaper she wrote for 33 years, the New York Times. But that didn't stop her from suing the paper in 1974. Robertson was part of a group of female employees that charged the Times with systematic sex discrimination. The lawsuit was settled out of court in 1978. Nan Robertson has now chronicled the New York Times' rocky history with women in a new book called The Girls in the Balcony. Robertson retired from the paper in 1988. She went on to write a book about her experiences in Alcoholics Anonymous called Getting Better. She told me about the balcony she refers to in the title of her new book.
The balcony at the National Press Club is a balcony that I stood in not so many years ago. It is where women reporters had to stand to hear world leaders speak at the National Press Club. It was decided in 1955 that they would let women reporters step over the threshold of the all-male National Press Club to cover events. And so what they did was they put us up in the balcony until 1971. And we were jammed up in that balcony, listening to, assigned to listen to these world leaders and to cover these events. We stood up in the balcony, packed together, while the men down on the ballroom floor, the members of the National Press Club, scarfed up a four-course meal. It was usually during luncheon. And not only could we not hear the speaker well, we got no lunch. We were standing instead of sitting. And we were not allowed to ask questions. We were showed. We were shown out at the end through a back door. We sort of skulked out through a back door. And this was true until 20 years ago, when the National Press Club, after years of internal fighting, finally admitted women as members.
Now, were you literally then staring down on the male reporters who were, as you say, scarfing down a very nice meal with obviously the speaker right in front of them?
Yes, it was at the other end of the ballroom. The podium was at the opposite end from the balcony. And it was worse than the back of the bus because the back of the bus, as one of my friends and colleagues points out in the book, gets everybody to the same destination just as well. We could not really cover well because we couldn't hear well. And so we started a little mutiny at the New York Times Bureau and told Scotty Reston, the great and idolized journalist who was our bureau chief, there were three women then in the bureau, that we will no longer cover events at the National Press Club until they brought us down from the balcony. And Reston was not pleased.
Did this balcony become a symbol of sexism in other news organizations as well, for other women who were there to cover speakers?
Of course it did. I mean, we all remember it. Everybody of our generation, I mean, great reporters and writers like Mary McGrory stood up there. And, you know, Pulitzer Prize winners, although there weren't many women Pulitzer Prize winners at the time. But it was humiliating. I mean, we were fuming up there, and we were hungry up there, and we were hot up there with the television crews up there with their hot lights. It was really, it was the worst, the ugliest symbol of discrimination in journalism that I know of.
Was the Times slow to hire female reporters?
Very. It was one of the most backward major papers in the nation to do so. The Times has always moved glacially, always moved slowly in terms of women. Its sort of male tone was set by the patriarch of the family that still owns it, Adolph Ox, who bought the New York Times in 1896. And for 40 years, while he was publisher, only four women got on the news staff, and they sort of sneaked in by mistake. He fought women's suffrage in his editorial columns, and personally, he believed women belonged at home. Meantime, his daughter Iphigenie, the great matriarch of the family, who really is figures in the background of this book, was sneaking her pocket money, all of it, to the Women's Suffrage Committee at Barnard College.
You began working at the Times in 1955. Can you describe for us then what it was like to work in this kind of environment where women working there then were considered somehow second-class employees?
When I came to the Times in 1955, I had 7 years behind me as a foreign correspondent doing general reporting for other newspapers. I was immediately sent to the women's page to cover fashion because once I had been a publicist for Dior and spent 5 years trying to get to the City Room, which is where you really learn the nuts and bolts of the trade because you cover everything. I finally got there. When I arrived at the Times, I mean, all of us women have described it this way. The City Room of the Times, a vast block-long room, was a sea of men. And there was a little handful of women, I think five at the time, who were all put in these. There was row after row of men. And then in the middle were the five women seated together, this island of women in a sea of men, as everybody described it.
When did you begin to sense that there were real salary disparities between what male reporters and female reporters were paid at the New York Times? People are often very private about their salaries, and it's sometimes very difficult information to get from people.
Well, we didn't get it from people in that way. You're quite right about people not wanting to discuss their salaries. What we did was, and I say we because I was a founding member of the Women's Caucus at the New York Times, what we did in the early 70s was to go to the payroll. We had access to that. We had the right to access. And the Newspaper Guild gave us the printouts of the payroll so that we could expunge the names but discover patterns of inequality. And that's when everybody really got mad. We found out that there was this disparity in wages between men and women doing the same jobs across the board.
How big was the disparity?
It was then about $3,000 a year, and it kept growing. Even though the Times was hiring more and more women reporters because their bylines were visible, the readers could see that more women were working for the Times. So more were hired by the City Room. But the disparity began at $59 a week and widened. That's about $3,000 a year. Widened until it was $7,000 a year in 1977, the year before the suit was settled on the day it was supposed to go to trial. So you have this, and that nothing makes people madder than to learn that they are paid less money for doing the same work.
Is that why you formed the Women's Caucus to begin to address some of these issues?
We formed it partly because that was the climate of the Times. Newsweek's women had already brought a suit in 1970. It was the modern women's movement emerged around 1970, and women were holding consciousness-raising groups all over the country. We became aware that there were inequities. I mean, my generation didn't get mad until we discovered how unequally we were being treated. I mean, we loved it when people said, "You think like a man," or "You write like a man." We thought that was a compliment. And so we had a certain, women of my generation had a kind of retroactive anger about the fact that we were patronized, that we were paid less, that we never got to be boss unless it was boss of the women's page. And it was a very salutary anger because it brought us to action.
When you brought this disparity to the attention of people at the New York Times, what was their reaction? Did they take you seriously?
Well, The first meeting with the management of the Times was in the very imposing boardroom on the 14th floor. The men sat on one side, the women sat on the other. Eileen Shanahan, a very great reporter, and I flew up from Washington to be there. And in retrospect, their attitude of astonishment and surprise reminded me of the senators during the Anita Hill Clarence Thomas hearings. Why, you mean that women really are paid less than men? I mean, that women can't cover sports, that nobody's in the pipeline to power, that they can't cover business and economics? Why, this is amazing. It was like the senators at the hearing, the Hill-Thomas hearings, being astonished that sexual harassment takes place in the workplace. And so their attitude was, why, we have to do something to correct this inequity, this series of inequities. We'll form committees. We'll have meetings. We'll do something about this. Punch Sulzberger is a genial, decent man. He was then publisher, and the men around him, one of them argued that he had, the Sunday editor, Dan Schwartz, argued at this meeting that, he said, why? He said, I'm bringing women along. I have a list here of the women I've made editors in the last few years. And the woman opposite him said, Dan, she said, the last time you made a woman in the Sunday department and an editor was 10 years ago, and I was that woman.
So did they think?
So everybody burst out laughing, and he was absolutely, nonplussed. I mean, he was really taken aback.
Well, let me quote the attorney that you hired to file the class action suit, and this is Harriet Schaffer Robb, and she said, talking about the Women's Caucus, they were so womanly, so accommodating. They believed that if you sat down and talked with management, everything would be okay.
That's exactly the way we felt at the beginning. And there ensued a series of dozens of meetings, and a very wonderful guy who was the specialist in labor relations, John Mortimer, went around to all of the managers below Punch Sulzberger, the publisher, and he would say, now we have to change this. We have to do something about this. We've got to bring more women in. We have to pay them equally. And the managers would say, sure, we'll act on this. And nothing happened, mostly because Punch did not lean on them and say, it's not enough to put out a quality paper. We have to treat the employees equally.
Nan Robertson is my guest, and from 1955 to 1988, she worked at the New York Times. She won a Pulitzer Prize for her story about her own near-fatal attack of toxic shock syndrome, and she's just written a book about a suit against the New York Times, a suit against the sex discrimination that many of the female employees discovered there, and the book is called The Girls in the Balcony. We're going to take a short break. This is Fresh Air. I'm speaking with journalist Nan Robertson, who's just written a book called The Girls in the Balcony, Women, Men, and the New York Times. What then made you want to file the class action suit, and what specifically then did you ask for in the suit?
We ask that that the disparity in salaries, which was ever growing during the negotiations that preceded the suit, that disparity be wiped out. We ask that there be a specific number of women in management, in various jobs that had been held only by men before. This was agreed to by the Times. It was settled on October 6, 1978, with all these promises from the Times. And very little follow through, even under court decree. Again, it was a lot of talking and very little action. The interesting thing is that there has been more action to close the gap in salaries and to put the women into positions of responsibility in recent years. For instance, in the 10 years after reunion in 1988 of the women of the Times, we just sort of talked about the gains and the losses, certainly in terms of women covering things. Women are covering sports. The national editor is a woman. The arts and leisure, the cultural Sunday section is the editor of that is a woman. You have a woman covering the Supreme Court. You have, for the first time, a co-chief White House correspondent, Maureen Dowd. In my generation, the women covered the White House family. That's it. I mean, they didn't cover the president unless the male correspondent was ill or out of town. So in every field of coverage, women now are making a change. I mean, look at the front page of the New York Times any day during this political year, and you will find female names. I mean, there were several of them up in New Hampshire doing front page stories about the New Hampshire primary.
And yet you seem to be saying that, that during these 4 years where the suit was going on and even the years that followed, mm-hmm. there wasn't much change at the New York Times.
There was not significant change. The country was changing and women were getting more and more opportunities, but it really isn't enough. However, the new publisher of the Times, young Arthur Sulzberger, Punch's son and heir, who just became publisher in January, has been fighting. Did fight as deputy editor and I hope deputy publisher and I hope will as publisher to close the gap in salaries. Let me give you an example. In about 1987, the gap across the board between men and women at the New York Times in the editorial side was $13,000. On the business side, it was $25,000. This is across the board. Young Arthur Sulzberger has, as his father has not, leaned on his managers and said that the Times must reflect the society and has closed the gap on new hires on the editorial side of the Times and has brought it down to about $7,000 on the business side. He is an avowed feminist. He is performing as one, and I see a lot of hope for the Times in the future.
You mentioned the fact that you were able to get to the payroll and get to see the disparities, again, between male and female employees at the Times.
Yes.
Were you also able to get to personnel files? Because that often contains information that can be very revealing in a different kind of way.
Of course we did. During the litigation, the lawyer got discovery rights, and so she was able to go into many hundreds of private memos. We got into the personnel records, personal correspondence involving the Times and so on, and some of those were extremely revealing and very disheartening.
In what way?
You would have the personnel manager telling a secretary that he didn't think she would get very far because her looks were not very great. You have the Sunday editor suggesting in jest but very tastelessly that a candidate for a job, a woman candidate, perhaps she could be send in her picture in a bikini. You have men saying, heads of departments saying, this woman is terrific. I'd make her my assistant if she were not a woman. I mean, it's all there. It was right there. And all the time, the salary gaps were widening. It was infuriating.
Were these then private conversations about female employees, or were these the kinds of things that men working at the Times felt they could say to the female employees?
Well, there were what one of the men called tits and ass cracks that were made and overheard by women employees, you know, conversations between men. And these were passed along as sort of oral history lore. I want to point out here that the women who sued the Times loved the Times. They really wanted to make it a better place to work. They know the respect in which the Times quite deservedly is held. They simply wanted to make it live up to its public stance. I mean, but all the time that we were litigating and negotiating with the management, and there were editorials in the Times saying this has got to reflect our corporations must reflect a diverse society. The lawyers were fighting the suits by the minorities and the women tooth and nail behind the scenes.
How much resentment would you say the suit created at the New York Times? And it was settled out of court.
Yes, in our favor.
In your favor.
I might add. Although the Times said we are totally vindicated and we have this wonderful affirmative action program. And as I described it, their press release that they issued the day that we won was, this has been a total vindication for the New York Times and our wonderful affirmative action program. And we will go on to do better things. And I said it all was sort of summed up in a statement I thought up, which was, we didn't do it and we won't ever do it. Again.
Well, why did the suit, though, bring no change?
But it did bring change. It brought all the changes that you see on the business side and on the editorial side, on women having many more opportunities. But getting up to now, to a certain level, I mean, that glass ceiling, but there are many more women in positions of power at the Times, not very high power. There are only three women on a masthead of 16 or 17 men, but that's more than there, you know, that there were 20 years ago or even 12 years ago. There have been changes at the Times, as there have been in the country. It's just, I feel, it's not far enough for half the population.
And those attitudes that you found in those personnel files, do you think those have changed as well? The ones
they have changed among the younger men, and that includes the new publisher. For instance, I broke open the last chapter of the book so that I could recount the episode last year of the unprecedented Times staffers protest meeting, which was called for them to face down management about the sleazebag coverage of the rape accuser in the Palm Beach William Kennedy Smith case. They thought, the staff thought, that the Times had really lowered its journalistic standards and was treating the woman before the trial like a slut.
Well, just to refresh our listeners, not only did the Times name this woman, which most of the newspapers around the country did not, mm-hmm. but went into her personal life in a very nasty kind of way.
They treated her like a slut. They treated her like a supermarket tabloid. And I wanted to make very plain that this meeting, which was called and which is unprecedented at the Times, there were 300 people packed into the WQXR auditorium within the building, that this incident demonstrates how much the attitudes have changed among the staff of the Times. For instance, almost half the people there in the audience were men. Many of them were younger men. Many of the younger men asked tough questions of the management. And Max Frankel appeared to sort of slide sideways. He sort of eluded the questioning. And Alan Siegel, whom I must praise, the assistant managing editor, admitted that he was stunned by the reaction, that it had changed his attitude, that for the first time in his life, he realized the grief and the outrage that women feel about rape, that it is an act of violence, that it's not a sexual act, that he read the story too hastily, that he had something pressing that was personal and left the building too soon. Alan stood four square, you know. Max didn't. I must say, in all fairness, that Soma Golden, the national editor, a woman, did not get it any better than Max. But by God, the women in that audience and the young men certainly got it.
Nan Robertson, thank you so much for joining us today.
Thank you, Marty.
Nan Robertson wrote for the New York Times from 1955 until 1988. Her book is called The Girls in the Balcony. I'm Marty Moscow-Wayne, and this is Fresh Air.
Major funding for Fresh Air is provided by the Corporation for Public Broadcasting. Additional support comes from the listeners of WHYY in Philadelphia, where Fresh Air is produced. This is NPR, National Public Radio.
From Philadelphia, I'm Marty Moscowain with Fresh Air. As a Japanese-American kid growing up in post-war Japan, Norma Field was often confused. When she went to the American school, people thought she was Japanese. When she visited her Japanese grandparents, the kids in the neighborhood threw rocks at her because they thought she was American. Coming up, we talk with Norma Field about a clash of cultures. Also, jazz critic Kevin Whitehead tells us about the new big band tradition coming out of Boston. That's all coming up on Fresh Air.
From National Public Radio News in Washington, I'm Ann Taylor. Israeli troops pulled back into the Israeli-declared security zone in South Lebanon today after a 24-hour incursion. This action has led Arab states to accuse Israel of terrorism. NPR's Linda Gradstein reports.
The next round of Middle East peace talks is set to begin in Washington on Monday. Throughout the Arab world today, Arab and Muslim leaders sharply condemned Israel's move beyond the security zone into South Lebanon. Palestinian spokeswoman Hanan Ashrawi said Israel's move was a provocative action aimed at impeding the Middle East peace process. An Iranian cleric called on Muslims around the world to donate money to the guerrillas fighting Israel. And 2,000 Muslims demonstrated in Istanbul. But at least so far, nobody has pulled out of the peace talks. Meanwhile, the violence continued in South Lebanon and northern Israel. A 5-year-old Israeli girl died in a rocket attack, and a Palestinian stabbed and killed a new Soviet immigrant to Israel in a town near Tel Aviv. I'm Linda Gradstein in Washington.
In New York City, the UN Security Council has approved sending 14,000 peacekeeping troops to Yugoslavia. The first soldiers are expected to arrive to keep watch over a ceasefire in about 2 weeks. The mission will be deployed for at least 1 year, unless the UN Security Council later decides to shorten the time. The force will be deployed in 3 Serbian-dominated areas of Croatia, which will be marked as UN-protected areas. This force will be the largest since the Congo operation during the 1960s. After 2.5 years on the job, National Endowment for the Arts chairman John Frohnmayer has resigned. During his tenure, he was attacked by conservatives for funding that they found offensive and by many in the arts community who charged that he was too responsive to the endowment's conservative critics. NPR's Ina Jaffe reports.
John Frohnmayer's resignation announcement this morning was described as an emotional scene. He addressed more than 200 endowment staffers, delivering a 9-point credo on the value of art, singing a bit of a Shaker hymn, and reciting poetry. Frohnmayer said it was his decision to leave and thanked President Bush for his support. But both conservatives and liberals say they believe the resignation was forced and that Frohnmayer was a casualty of election year politics. Patrick Buchanan, who made a strong showing against President Bush in the New Hampshire primary, has blasted the National Endowment for the Arts for supporting works that he terms filthy and blasphemous. John Frohnmayer's resignation is effective May 1st. He says he plans to work in law or with a private foundation for, quote, quality art, for less hate, and for a generosity of spirit that allows us to live with our differences. I'm Ina Jaffe reporting.
On Wall Street, the Dow Jones Industrials moved down less than 1 point to close at 3,280.19. This is NPR News. On Capitol Hill, the Senate has approved a bill to increase aid to poor and middle-income college students by a vote of 93-1. This measure is expected to cost almost $57 billion over 5 years' time and would allow more middle-income students to get help from the Pell Grant program by raising the family income limit to $42,000. That limit is now at around $30,000. Schools with loan payback default rates over 25% would be taken out of the loan program. In Africa, Nelson Mandela, leader of the African National Congress, said today that a Conservative Party victory in a referendum to test white support for reforms would be a tragedy for the country. Virgil Keane of the BBC reports.
This was Nelson Mandela's first public response to President de Klerk's announcement. He reiterated the ANC's rejection of any racially based referendum, but again avoided any criticism of President de Klerk, and he went on to give a stark warning about the implications of a Conservative Party victory. However, Mr. Mandela said people should remember that the National Party once occupied exactly the same position as the Conservative Party, yet it was now talking to the ANC. We will do to the Conservatives exactly as we did to the Nationalists, Mr. Mandela said. The ANC leader knows that he must tread a cautious path in his public comments on the referendum, avoiding any remarks that could play up white fears and give ammunition to the Conservatives in their onslaught against President de Klerk.
Virgil Keane in Johannesburg. Health officials in Los Angeles say that 60 passengers on board an Argentine airplane last Friday now have cholera symptoms. Officials say a 70-year-old man has died of cholera. Health officials say it's believed that there was contaminated food or water on the flight to Los Angeles, perhaps taken on board at a stopover in Lima, Peru. This is National Public Radio News in Washington.
This is Fresh Air. Norma Field grew up next to an American Army base in Japan. She was a war baby. Her father was an American soldier stationed in that country during the occupation after World War II. Her mother was Japanese. Field's parents met because her grandfather used to bring home American GIs to teach his children how to speak English. Like many Japanese after the war, he was crazy about American culture. Her parents divorced when she was seven. Norma Field came to the States to go to college and is now settled in Chicago. She teaches Japanese literature at the University of Chicago. Several years ago, she returned to her childhood home in Tokyo for a long visit. Her time in Japan coincided with the prolonged illness and eventual death of Japan's Emperor Hirohito in 1989. In the Realm of a Dying Emperor is Field's book about the Japan she observed during that year-long visit. It's part autobiography, part history, and part examination of modern Japanese culture. I spoke with Norma Field about living in occupied Japan and moving between the army base and the rest of the country.
I made the journey every day, and what I remember very distinctly is chocolate-colored army buses between my home and the base. But I think that base culture was very central to most of the Americans there as part of the occupation. And going around in the Japan around them was a combination of the conqueror's experience and the touristic one. So you could move around, but it wasn't a neutral moving around.
Your mother was Japanese, your father American, and
right.
You called yourself a half-breed daughter in a defeated land. Is that how you felt?
Very much. In the American school, I was, and on the buses, I still remember very vividly as a kindergartner, fourth grade girls interrogating me and asking me if I had any brothers or sisters, and I said no, and finally they looked at each other and said, she must be Japanese. And then off base in my grandparents' completely Japanese neighborhood, a lot of kids would call me, would kind of jeer at me as an American, a foreigner. And I remember some experiences of having pebbles and rocks thrown at me. So, I felt very much an outsider in both worlds.
Did you see yourself then as this real half-breed, half-American, half-Japanese person? Or did you feel yourself identifying with more one culture over the other?
I remember that since I lived in a completely Japanese household in spite of my father's presence, I would go to school, and when we're asked to make teacups or draw things around the house, I always came up with Japanese furnishings, and my grandmother would be mortified and said, oh, no, 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 we have to teach Norma what Western domestic things look like. So even in the Japanese circumstances, I think I was always being trained to efface, or at least to learn to pass as an American. And I really, really, as a child, wanted to be Caucasian. I would look at myself on sunny days and the glass doors and look at the red highlights in my hair that would only show up then and think, gee, maybe I'm turning whiter.
You write in your book, and this is about biracial children, and you write, they were nothing if not the embodiment of sex itself. Now I modify it. The biracial offspring of war are at once more offensive and intriguing because they bear the imprint of sex as domination. That's a very powerful phrase. powerful idea.
Yeah, yeah. Now, in my case, because my parents were married and because I was very strictly raised and educated, I didn't live the stark marginality of all the many, many, many illegitimate children produced by World War II and the Korean War. And I do remember at the time of the Vietnam War, the baby lift, when a number of particularly biracial children were being airlifted out of Vietnam to be sent for adoption in the United States. Contrary to my usual political affiliations, I felt that progressive types in America who said we're robbing the Vietnamese of their future, I felt, you know nothing about what it means to look different in a traditional culture. By which I mean that I think Americans of whatever race can be insensitive to racism within non-Western societies.
How would you say the American occupation affected the Japanese culture, even the Japanese spirit, to be an occupied country after World War II?
Yeah, I think that, and this is direct bearing on the present moment, I think that by and large it was a very warmly embraced occupation. The cliche almost is candy bars and chewing gum, that's what American GIs were tossing out to hungry children. Of course, there are particularly older men who really think of it in sexual terms of Japan having been womanized and raped. But I would say that's a distinct minority opinion. Japanese occupation brought with it American occupation of Japan brought with it American popular culture. And Japanese went for it like fish to water, like people everywhere around the world, certainly in those days. And to this day, American popular culture, unlike American cars, is enormously influential and loved in Japan.
When you came to the United States, how would you compare then living here as a Japanese American as opposed to living in Japan?
I felt enormously liberated, and I say that as someone who tends to be quite critical and alienated from many things American or American government policy and the like. In those days, still in Japan, I would go home on vacations from college and just go down to the corner store to get something, and if I go out in my dungarees, my grandmother would be upset. This is completely different now. I'm talking 20 years ago. But the fact that I could be anonymous in America was such a gift after feeling so conspicuous, whatever I did and whatever age I was in Japan, that, it's still infinitely easier.
Norma Field is my guest. She teaches Japanese literature as an associate professor at the University of Chicago. And she's written a book called In the Realm of a Dying Emperor, and it's in part an autobiography, also a look at Japanese relationship to its past and an examination of the Japanese culture today. We're going to take a short break. This is Fresh Air. My guest is Norma Field, and her book is called In the Realm of a Dying Emperor. You returned to Japan a few years ago, mm-hmm. and as it turned out, your visit coincided with the rather protracted death of Japan's Emperor Hirohito. How did Japan observe his dying?
That was an extraordinary experience. As most of your listeners will no doubt know, Japan is what people might call a postmodern. Certainly Tokyo is a postmodern society now. People don't normally think much about the emperor, the imperial institution at all. And yet, with his collapse in mid-September, everything began to change in the society. There, of course, had been plans for this, or thinking about it, because he was elderly and had surgery the year before. And to give you an indication of the conjuncture that this was, there was enormous debate about whether it was appropriate for a knife to penetrate the jeweled sovereign body, jeweled being literally an epithet to honor the emperor's body. So after he collapsed, and because it was uncertain when the death would take place, everyone began to think about what they should be doing to show their concern. Department stores wondered what, and the day of the death had long been murmured about as X Day. Department stores wondered how they should instruct their customers on X Day. Still baseball season, when what should happen? What should the crowds be told? Should the game count if three innings had been played? Should it be dispersed? Movie theaters also worrying about what they should do, and they began to consult with each other. The media, radio and television, what kind of programming was appropriate? They stocked up on nature programs. It was thought that that would be dignified enough. And a lot of Bach. We heard a lot of Bach those days.
You make an interesting point there. This is talking about how the press was reporting on his condition. Mm. On the one hand, they never told the public that he had abdominal cancer.
Right.
But on the other hand, there were detailed accounts of all his bodily functions.
Extraordinary. Both the vomiting of blood and rectal bleeding. And the term for rectal bleeding was unfamiliar. I think it sent a lot of people to their dictionaries. But nevertheless, we had accounts of his temperature and the amount of rectal bleeding and the amount of blood transfusion. So, of course, people started circulating vampire stories and the like. The practice of not talking about cancer, it still is relatively, it's quite non-standard in Japan not to tell cancer patients of their condition. And in fact, I have discussed that really as a kind of a sign of the emperor system itself, that patients not be told.
Why was Emperor Hirohito so revered in Japan? And he, of course, was emperor when Japan was at war during World War II. Japan was defeated at the end of World War II.
Mm-hmm. Yes, he is revered. And in the hours and hours of documentaries that were played after his death, everyone used the stock phrase of the light and dark of his reign. The dark, of course, being the pre-war and wartime years. I think that he is revered precisely because he presided over Japanese economic recovery in the post-war years, and that is very much the longer part of his reign. If he hadn't lasted so long into high-growth economics, for instance, I don't think he could have been revered in the way he came to be. Because he himself never had to take responsibility for the war, which is an issue, of course, that became very central during the months of his dying. He, in a sense, allowed the Japanese to have a guilt-free post-war history.
What do the history books then say about World War II and Emperor Hirohito? How do they write about?
Well, in order to understand that, you have to understand how centralized Japanese education is. Everything, for example, there are books that tell you what day's field day can be held in Japanese elementary schools and when the opening ceremony should be all around the country. Remember, this is a country that exists in one time zone. The education ministry also gets to screen all textbooks. This, of course, has become became a major issue in the 1980s because of complaints coming from Japan's neighbors, namely China and Korea, about the ways in which, for example, what we refer to as the rape of Nanking is treated in Japan. It's reminiscent of the American debate over incursion and invasion in Vietnam, in fact. And the ignorance or the cover-up of Japanese atrocities, both in colonized Korea and in China. When there have been progressive historians attempting to write about this in textbooks, they have run into Ministry of Education censorship, and there are long, long trials still ongoing about what can be printed in Japanese textbooks about Japanese wartime history.
Now, do you have children of your own?
Yes.
Have you taken them back to Japan?
Quite a bit, yes.
And for them, what does the country look like through their eyes? Can you tell?
My daughter, who is now 16 and was very involved in the writing of this book, has enormous investments in Japan, and particularly in her Japanese family. She's very attached. In fact, both the children really are attached to it. At the same time, I think what it has done, particularly for my daughter, because she's older, is to understand what it means to be attached to a society and yet be critical of it. It's mm-hmm. given her both a place to look at America critically, and then living in America gives her a place to look at Japan critically.
And for you, then, is it any easier to move between those two countries and cultures?
Yes, I think so. I think so. I mean, I remain profoundly attached to Japan in a way that puzzles me sometimes, but there I am.
Puzzles you because?
Because the society is just so ruthless and so... you begin to feel that you can't breathe when you're there. Because I don't work there, because I'm not part of the society in that way, I don't have to experience that. I don't have to suffocate in the way so many of my friends do.
Norma Field, I thank you so much for joining us today on Fresh Air.
Thank you very much.
Norma Field is the author of In the Realm of a Dying Emperor, A Portrait of Japan at Century's End. This is Fresh Air. Noah Adams has joined us to tell us about All Things Considered today. Hi, Noah, what are you covering?
Hi, Marty. Jane Howard reports from Yugoslavia and the Krajina region there about the refusal of some Serbian forces to disarm and go along with the ceasefire. An Italian ski racer has won the women's 30K cross-country race at the Winter Games. We'll talk with a reporter in Le Saisy, that's the village where the races are being held, about today's event and the overall performance of the American team. A New York State baker, Daniel Leader, tells us about a fuss in Paris. An ordinance against wood-burning fires is threatening the few bakers who are still doing it the old-fashioned way. Also, a 50th anniversary salute to the Voice of America.
Thanks, Noah. Those stories and more later today on All Things Considered from National Public Radio. Used to be that big bands were the thing. Now they're pretty much a thing of the past. But jazz critic Kevin Whitehead says he's found a couple of big bands from Boston, where teachers and students are drawn to schools like the New England Conservatory and the Berklee College of Music. He'll tell us about those bands in just a minute. But first, a few words about a more familiar orchestra.
From Hollywood! 1992 will mark the end of an era in jazz. When Johnny Carson leaves The Tonight Show in May, Doc Severinsen and the orchestra are going along. That means most Americans may never hear a big band again, let alone one whose leader they could name. But this isn't entirely bad news. With all due respect to Doc and Tommy and the boys, their idea of a big band sound, with its heavy dose of screeching trumpets and flashy drum breaks, is kind of played out. As some younger bands have discovered, it doesn't have to be that way. That's the orchestra Orange Then Blue, playing a piece by its drummer, George Schuller. Its trumpet players can still screech, and the drums can still get loud, but the band's writers have obviously been listening to hipper stuff than Doc Severinsen's. One obvious influence is the music of composer Carla Bley. Saxophonist Matt Dario's tune Panama takes its cue from Bley's tropical tangos, but the weirdly woozy phrasing is all its own. Doc would never play that loose. His band, like lots of others, prides itself on precision. But music, like other arts, can be energized by sudden reversals and accepted wisdom. Accepted wisdom in this case being that more precise playing is better. Even so, Orange Then Blue doesn't turn its back on history. The group's latest album, Funkayero, on the GM label, includes a Charlie Parker tune, an arrangement of some Bulgarian choral music, and a couple of pieces by the late Gil Evans. Evans's low-key approach to orchestral jazz in the 50s and 60s still sounds fresh, and it's a model for a lot of contemporary writers, among them Ken Schaphorst. He's led his Boston band on two very nice CDs, although Schaphorst has since moved to Wisconsin. His last album, After Blue, is on Accurate Records. This is from the title track. Schaphorst has the good taste to be a Duke Ellington fan, too. He doesn't go in for obvious Ellingtonian effects, like wah-wah trumpets or a jabbing piano. But one theme in Schaphorst's tune After Blue paraphrases Chelsea Bridge by Duke's aide-de-camp Billy Strayhorn. Ken Schaphorst does a whole lot of different stuff on his new album to show his command of the big band idiom. In fact, some of his charts wouldn't sound out of place on The Tonight Show. Not to tell Jay Leno his business. He's done okay for himself without my help. But if using Branford Marsalis's little band on the show doesn't work out, he could do worse than drafting Schaphorst. True, Ken Schaphorst is not a household name, but how many viewers had heard of Doc before he got the gig?
Kevin Whitehead is a freelance writer based in New York City. He reviewed Orange Then Blue by Funkalero and After Blue by the Ken Schaphorst Big Band. Our engineers this week are Audrey Voblaitis, Thad Kirk, Ron Barron, and Richard Parker. Chris Burgeon directs the show. I'm Marty Moss Cohen.
Major funding for Fresh Air is provided by the Corporation for Public Broadcasting. Additional support comes from the listeners of WHYY in Philadelphia, where Fresh Air is produced. This is NPR, National Public Radio.
On the next Fresh Air, a look inside the former Soviet Union with Pulitzer Prize-winning journalist Hedrick Smith. Smith just returned from the independent states, gathering material for a new documentary to be aired on Public TV's Frontline series. That and more coming up on the next Fresh Air.